Welcome to After Six. Todd Feinberg here. Joining us now, one of our semi-regulars, Jeffrey Tucker. He's with, I don't even remember what it's called. A-E-I-R. A-I-E-R.
That's right. It's impossible to say. In fact, one of the things that happens when you work here is that you develop an expertise in saying A-I-E-R.
Wow.
And people kind of marvel at it.
Well, you practice while you're driving into work.
You have to, because if that's when you work here and you say the name wrong, then that's deeply regrettable.
And that stands for American Institute for Economic Research.
That's so right. You're, just think of the four most boring words in the English language. Those
American
are those words.
Institute yeah. Economic Research. Well, American's pretty exciting.
Yeah, that is, but it's overused probably.
Yes, but the other three are sleepers, no question.
I love it. I love our name. And people have been telling us for years, they're like, you know, you really should change the name to something a little catchier. Yeah. Like what? Economify. Whatever. Actually, I like the boringness of my name. I think it's really kind of lovely.
Anyway, just like shoulder pads in men's suits, someday they'll be back, and you'll be at the peak of some wonderful trend.
It's not, it's interesting. We have had this name for 86 years. It seems to be going pretty well. So I don't think we need to be improved. Yeah.
All right. So you've got a new book out, The Market Loves You, Why You Should Love It Back. Give us a quick primer on this book, because all your ideas are wonderful, and I'd like to hear what inspired you for this tomb.
We are surrounded everywhere by commerce and its products, and it makes our lives great. It defines our lives. It defines our times. It increases our engagement with the world. It brings delight to us. But it's so much, though, sort of the water we swim in that we don't think about it a lot. And so we pick up the newspapers, and there's the usual pundit saying, capitalism's terrible, commercial society's running the world, you know. And they say that now on the left and on the right. And it's tedious because it's not true. Within the commercial world, we find expressions of love everywhere, love that you have for others and love that others have for you. And the love is associated with creativity, with sharing, with finding new ways to improve our lives, which is what markets are really all about. So the purpose of my book is to really recast the economic debate in terms of a system that's benevolent and cooperative, which is capitalism, as versus a system that's restrictive and grasping and parasitical, which I consider to be all the ways in which government and political classes try to improve on the commercial society and fail.
But I don't even think they're trying to improve upon it. I just think they're trying to scam us with arguments to cover up what they're actually up to.
That's right. Well, it depends. You know, it really depends on who it is and who's talking. I mean, and I'm with you on this. Sometimes I read these things and I think, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez doesn't really believe that the Green New Deal is going to adjust climate patterns around the world 50 years from now. This is all just kind of a hoax. She just wants, crush accomplished people who she secretly loathes or something. I don't really know. And I feel like, I don't want to be one-sided about this. You know, does Trump actually believe that taxing Americans through tariffs is actually making us rich? I don't know. I think he does. So it's a mixed bag. But you're right. I mean, a lot of the times it's just propaganda, but a lot of the times I think it really is confusion. And part of the purpose of my book, really, it's the sole purpose of my book, is to instill or inspire a kind of appreciation for what the commercial society does for us in our lives. And so I take apart everything, really. I mean, the book just goes through every kind of product you can imagine. I go through a lot of history of technology, history of the mechanical clock, where it came from, what it accomplished, why the supply met the demand to the point that we had a gigantic mechanical clock industry in this country. You know, the origin of stereophonic records, but even I have essays in this book about a can of tuna salad that I find is actually kind of remarkable, that I got out of a vending machine once for $1.50, and I dissected over the ingredients. And
This was tuna fish, canned tuna fish that already had the mayonnaise and celery mixed in.
Yeah, that stuff's amazing. Really, it really is.
That's great.
But, you know, you think about the fishermen. You know, like tuna are very fast fish, and they travel up and down the East Coast, you know, at extraordinary speeds. And so, going out and fishing for them is really it's a full time job, and it's full of risks and dangers. And you're reeling onto the boat this gigantic thing, and then you have to somehow get it back through refrigeration, you know, and serve it fresh, and or, you know, can it? And there's a lot that goes into the process. And then you think about combining it with pickles from God knows where, and, you know, the mayonnaise, and, you know, a little bit of salt, and vinegar, where does that come from? The industrial processes and just sheer human labor associated with making a can of tuna fish with mayonnaise and pickles in it that you can just buy for $1.50, it's actually like a miracle once you think about it. It's overwhelming
what capitalism has done to transform our lives, because we don't have to figure out how to get that tuna out of the sea. Forget it. We struggle with just, we have to open the can and that becomes a burden. So we have somebody else figure out how to dice up the celery for us or pickles in your recipe. I mean, it is incredible that all of human history was about struggling to get the next meal or a next meal, and we are suffering the opposite. We can't hold the food off from entering our mouths.
It is really, we have the opposite problem. And we complain about it. We're like, oh, well, there's just too much food. I'm eating too much, you know. So that is, you know, we've conquered that. But even things like, you know, the ability to tell time. Really, very late in human history did the average middle class person have a clock in the house. That was in a remarkable kind of a transformation of life. That happened sometime in the 1880s, actually, because I was just over in Budapest, you know, so every cathedral had gigantic clocks on them, you know, some of them from the 15th, 16th century. The reason for that was so that people could tell time. And then we privatized that over the centuries and eventually came up with this idea of a mechanical clock that's in your house. I'm in love with these little things, and the history of them is quite spectacular. And they're fun. We have, I guess, about five of them here at AIR, and I just love them. They're so humane. And also, it's actually funny because, you know, we're so used to plugging everything in or replacing the batteries with everything, you know, charging everything up. That is slightly amazing when you come across a mechanical thing that seems to work just through springs.
Willing to go on forever, virtually.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's really fun. And we even have a beautiful phonograph here from 1916 that runs for 10 minutes with 40 cranks, you know, and plays beautiful music. And it's, sometimes the simpler technologies make us more appreciative of the complexity of invention. Whereas we look at our cell phones, and it's just like this magic box. You know, we don't know how it works.
It's beyond us to even know how to wonder about. It's so far advanced.
Yeah.
Right, we're talking with Jeffrey Tucker from AIER, American Institute for Economic Research, and discussing his new book, Why the Market Loves You, Why You Should Love It Back. And so you've run through a bunch of things that capitalism has provided us. And it's interesting that you say this, because I've been saying on the radio on a regular basis that really the only thing that produces for us is business, that we need these corporations desperately more than anything else. And maybe that's what really upsets the politicians, is that they have competition, that really everybody else is a leech organization designed to live off their vig from what the rich people and the corporations are creating. And I'm articulating this so maybe we can get a better handle on what's going on in this game. Because here in Connecticut, the political class is unaware of the notion of scarcity, which you discussed beautifully in a couple of recent columns. And they think somehow, after having bankrupted the state with the second highest liabilities, unfunded liabilities to state workers of any state in the country, their idea is to not talk about the need for confronting that reality and restructuring those debts. They make up phony stories about things we need. Oh, we really need new bridges and roads, yep. and so we need tolls. And they make up all these as if people can pay forever. But we're the second highest departure state in the country. People are just leaving.
Well, you know, look, I can tell you what I think I know what's going on here. And if you track this back, going back, say, like 400 years, what you find is that every new bout of freedom that's been granted unto the population, every great material achievement that the market makes, when it gets really explosive and big and transformative so that our lives are dramatically different as a result of the freedom, so that the state becomes ever less sort of important and people start resenting it more, what this does is it inspires the political class into a kind of a panic of their own relevance. They start to think, wait, do people imagine that they can get by without us? That's not going to work. So they plot and they scheme and they plan. And again, it's both the right and the left to clamp down, to crack down, and bring new controls and regulations. This happened 100 years ago. During the Progressive Era, you know, late 19th century, we didn't have an income tax, we didn't have passports, we didn't have labor regulations, we didn't have anything. And we had huge growth and transformed lifestyles, massive increase in income, lifespans, reduction in poverty, and so on and so on. Then the political class panicked. You don't forget about us, don't forget about us. And so they did everything terrible. They created a Fed, created an income tax, had a big World War, war, and we regulated labor and so on. Everything became to be regulated in this. In an instant, it's like in just a few years. So I think we're going through that same thing now, because in the last 20 years, we've had the digital revolution. We've had uptick in global cooperation for human productivity. It's outrageous when you look at the charts, how integrated the world economy is now compared to what it was even 30 years ago. And all of our technologies are overwhelming our lives, and we've been given so many great things, and we live and breathe the private sector now. And I think the political class is once again panicked. They're like, wait, this is going too far, way too much freedom, way too much choice. This just can't last. We've got to get hold of this system and crack down on it. So I think that's what's really driving our times right now, and it's bad. The politics of our time is grim. I don't know if you feel that, but I do every day.
Well, I feel there's a certain celebratory era right now where the most resonant language I think of the presidential election a couple of years ago was Bernie's use of the word rigged, and that seems to have resonated in a magical way that all of us were walking around feeling that there's a maturity that the country has experienced economically, development, whatever it is, that everything's been, we've got such affluence now, and it's all been divided up, and the real estate isn't abundant, the government's not looking to give it away to populate any states anymore. We're now sort of filled up, and that's created a new dynamic where we feel that everything's locked in place, and the measures seem to indicate that we do have less mobility economically. And so if the norms are the thing that protect us from the disintegration of our democratic principles, the norms are also then by definition the thing that confines us. And I think people are feeling those norms as a confinement, and then Donald Trump as the burster of norms works out kind of nicely as a reprieve.
Oh, I think it was something to say. And that's why people love Trump, because he's outrageous. He says the unsayable all the time, and he's won the affection of so many people as a result. I think it's somewhat dangerous, because I think he's actually misusing a lot of the affection that he has for him with these trade wars. I think they're very dangerous. But I think he'll also make a really good point about land and real estate. You know, there are development restrictions that you get in, I think you talk about Connecticut, but I mean, you look at a place like Silicon Valley in San Francisco, you know, the restrictions on development there are so extreme that people really are feeling contained and restrained, and they lack mobility, lack opportunity, and there's a great deal of frustration. Now, a lot of this results from, of all things, government intervention itself, right? I mean, it's the high taxes, the regulations. We're all starting to pay a price for this. So the answer, I think the answer to all the economic problems that people have is more tax cuts, more deregulation, more opportunity, more freedom. But that's not what we're being told by the New York Times and the Washington Post. You know, they're preaching to us every day we need more government, more government.
Well, yes. So that's an important point. I left out of the list the most insidious force, and that is government confining us with hyper-regulation, with hyper-taxation, and with a sense that they want to control all the resources and that Washington has to control that which should be controlled at the state level, and the state has to control that which should be done at the local level.
Yeah, it's a really, what we're losing, I think, in this country, it's actually very shocking to me when you think about it. Is that basic point about human liberty. Liberty was the reason for the framing of the Constitution. It was the reason for the original War of Independence. It was the animating contribution that this country gave to the world.
Gives.
Human liberty, individualism, opportunity.
Like, yes.
We know this, right? If we know it so well, why are we working so hard to get rid of it?
Because we don't know it anymore, though, Jeffrey. We don't know it because we've been propagandized about how government has to give us everything and how much better it will be now that they've made a disaster of college education, for example, by doing student loans and created the newest, biggest center of debt for the nation and ruined college, I think, because they've frozen them and they don't innovate their models because they got so much money coming. And why would they?
Yeah, and ideologically and philosophically, this is terrible for the students because, you know, they can go to classes all day and learn about this and learn about this, but when they get home, they're, you know, they get out of the marketplace, they're like, wait, I'm going to be in debt until I'm 40? You know.
Yeah, so now we need free college for all and we need to pay off their debts. So we need socialism to help them recover from the socialism we inflicted on them.
That is exactly it. I really think that the college debt situation has a lot to do with the ideological corruption of the generation because they're not independent. When you're in debt, that in debt, you are not independent. You're not free to make your own decisions. You're not free to suddenly to take a low-paying job at a startup, for example. They can't do it. So they get shoved into a corporate bureaucracy they don't like, or they end up having to work minimum wage jobs that they feel like they're overqualified for, and so on. It just leads to a general sense of disgruntlement and anger. Actually, somebody told me recently, I haven't looked this up, that Karl Marx himself had never thought of socialism until he ran into personal financial problems.
So he knew exactly what it was.
Yeah, and so he got angry at capitalism because he thought it was pillaging him and putting him in a personal financial box because he got himself too much in debt. So it's really interesting to consider what does sort of bad personal financial management do to one's philosophical outlook. It's kind of grim to think of. And it's really tragic that these kids are taking on these gigantic loans at the age of 18. I mean, you're not in a position to do that at the age of 18. It's crazy. And even worse are the kids that, you know, they're in school 2 or 3 years, or maybe they're just short of their degree, and then they get sick of it, and they walk away, and they still got their debt, but they don't have a degree. Not that your degree does anything for you, but I mean...
Well, that's true, too. But completion would be at least gratifying if you're going to walk around with debt for the next 30 years because of what you bought.
You know, probably what we should do is just give everyone at birth a PhD, and that way... We would
with no knowledge to go with it, and that way we don't have to worry about dumbing things down over time.
That would solve a lot of problems.
This is great. All right, we're out of time, unfortunately, because I feel like we could talk for another hour or so. Jeffrey Tucker is the author of The Market Loves You, Why You Should Love It Back.
There we go.
Best of luck with the book, and come back and see us soon, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
Bye-bye.